Since the era of the French Revolution, commentators and politicians have referred to the press as the fourth estate, signifying the important, if informal, role of the press in public life. Today's guest leads a nonprofit news agency extending the power of the press to undercovered corners of the world. He's Charles Sennett, this week on Story in the Public Square. Welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter. To do that, we sit down every week with the best storytellers around, authors, journalists, filmmakers, and more, to make sense of the big stories shaping public life in the United States today. To help us this week, we're joined by Charles Sennett, founder, executive director, and editor-in-chief of the Ground Truth Project, a nonprofit news organization that supports a new generation of journalists telling the stories from the undercovered corners of the world. Charlie, thank you so much for being with us.
Jim, thanks for having me.
So we want to talk to you about the Ground Truth Project, but walk us a little bit through your progression. You're a working journalist. You started local. You went foreign. You're now focusing on some local issues again. Talk to us about that evolution.
Sure. So I've always said that for me it began with local news, and you know I worked like back in the day that was the journey. You could start off in local and you'd work your way up to regional, then national, and then foreign, and there was a real trajectory to your career there. So I started off in public radio at WFCR in Amherst. I then went to work at the Bergen Record in New Jersey, and at the Record, you know, covered a lot of stories that were local, but was constantly looking for ways to think of them in a global context and to push the boundary there. So for example, covered Irish immigrants and then basically talked my editors into saying, you know, we should go do this story in Ireland. There's so many little towns that no longer even have young people who live here. So that's sort of been an MO of mine from really the earliest days, but it was the New York Daily News. I covered cops, I covered courts, and you know, would cover crack cocaine when you had to describe what it was every time you wrote that word, crack cocaine. And really then that led to reporting in Medellin, Colombia. But the biggest example of that local to global journey for me was being at the New York Daily News in 1993 and hearing a loud bang in Lower Manhattan and realizing that there's something going on, because after the bang followed sirens. So I started to just go toward where people were coming from, and people had soot on their face. There was smoke pouring out of the basement of the World Trade Center, out of the parking garage. No one knew what happened. Everyone knew was there was a loud bang, there was a rumbling sound, and there's a lot of smoke. But as I got closer and closer, we began to see that this is pretty extensive. There's hundreds of people injured here. No one, not a single person, thought it was terrorism. It was 1993. It was the first time the World Trade Center was struck. But in those early hours, there was no one on the live reporting scene saying, this is terrorism, which is a stunning fact now, right? So I called my editor back in the days when you used to have to actually call from a payphone, and said, there's something going on here. I'm going to get inside and see what this is. And I did. I got inside, went across the police line, got down towards the scene, saw them when they were stringing some emergency lighting, and there was a five-story deep crater with cars piled down in it. And I knew it was a bomb. So I called the desk and said, this is a bombing. I had done Medellin, Colombia. I had done Belfast. I knew what a bombing looked like. I didn't need much more than to see how they were responding to this. Quickly, the story emerged that it was indeed a bombing, and it was the first real terrorist strike on American soil in the Middle Eastern context. And so we began a series of reports that, for me, were police reporting. Who would want to take down the World Trade Center? who are these guys? And if you remember, there were a couple of people who were sort of the henchmen around this scene. They were sort of the fall guys in some ways. And one of them was named Mohammed Salameh, and he went and got the deposit on the Ryder rental truck that had been used in the bombing, truck bombing
after,
in the basement.
Right?
After.
Yeah.
And he went back to get his return, and I was there. And FBI said, you got to get out of here. And there were a couple of us reporters who were around at the time because we knew there was a Ryder rental involved. And sure enough, it was Salameh pulling up. FBI just swooped in on him, and he was arrested as the first real big break in the case. And so I always think back on this, that I've covered the Middle East now for almost 25 years. I've been assigned there as a foreign correspondent. I've covered wars there. I've been a bureau chief in the Middle East for the Boston Globe. But it really began for me as a cop story, local story, pounding the pavement, you know, going out and getting the story, and it led to this trajectory of looking at that question, who'd want to blow up the World Trade Center for the next 25 years?
Let me ask you this question. That's fascinating. That's a fascinating story. But the skills that you develop covering cops and covering crime in a local U.S. newspaper, how does that translate to when you're the bureau chief for the Middle East for the Boston Globe?
Great question. I'd say it's a direct connectivity. I had a wonderful city editor named Bill Boyle. And Boyle understood that we were just really good street reporters, myself and a sort of team of a bunch of young reporters who were really eager. We were really like living this story out in the last great newspaper war in America, and it was very competitive. It was the New York Times, it was Newsday, it was the New York Post, it was the New York Daily News, and someone was going to be around and someone wasn't. And it was a time of great competition and camaraderie, and I was so lucky to work with people like Pete Hamill, Jimmy Breslin, Mike McAlary, who was kind of the columnist who was between our generations. But all of those people had one thing in common. They were all police reporters. All of us really, really worked at police reporting. And so, to me, digging the story out on the street, asking the kind of questions you need to do to be resourceful on the street translated perfectly. So when I got deep into that first World Trade Center bombing, Boyle said, you should go. You should go over and find out who these guys were. And to me, there's not that much difference.
Go to the Middle East.
Yeah. When you go to Brooklyn and you try to find out who they are, or you go to Jersey City to find out about the mosque where Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman, the spiritual leader, was building a community, try to find out their messaging. It wasn't a huge leap of faith for me to get on a plane and go to Cairo and then go into Khartoum in the Sudan, and eventually go to the West Bank, and eventually even go to Pakistan, where the real mastermind, a guy named Ramzi Youssef, was located. But it was all police reporting on a crime, which was an attack of the World Trade Center. And I think, honestly, now 25 years later, and I've covered terrorism all over the world, sadly, since then, I think it is really healthy to think of terrorism as a crime, and to think of yourself as a crime reporter going after the story. It's solid, it's the way to do it, it's the way you ask the simple questions that lead one connection to the next.
So we're going to get into the skills of street reporting, how useful they are still today in this age when a lot of journalists may be tempted to stay in their newsrooms, their offices, do the Facebook, the Google, the Twitter, and it's a lot easier. There's still such value to getting out there on the street. And I know that's something you bring to the young people you train.
Right.
But so we'll get to that in a minute.
Okay.
Tell us about Ground Truth. What was the genesis of that?
Sure.
That's your current...
So Ground Truth's a word that I first heard covering the war in Iraq. And when I heard it, I was with an embed, and I kept hearing this phrase, you know, what's the ground truth in that area of operation? I thought, that's an interesting phrase. I kind of wrote it down. It's very obvious what it means. It means the truth from that area of operation or that sector. Then I started asking around about it, and one of the military guys said to me, you know, that's not just an obvious term, that's a technical term. We need ground truth to be able to paint the targets. And I thought, what are you talking about? And so what I learned and what I've come to understand is ground truth is a very technical term used in calibrating satellite technology. Satellites read many things. They read visuals, so pixels that need to align. They read temperature. They read barometric pressure. They can read a number of different things. But the sophistication of the technology in the satellite can only make sense and only be providing a true reading if there's something called the ground truth, which is someone on the ground measuring it in real time to compare it to the technology and to calibrate or recalibrate if there's a there's a discrepancy. So I never think of NASA as poetic, but they said, you know, when you have a conflict between the technology and the ground truth, trust the human reading. And so I feel like that's what I've done with my reporting my whole life, is to go into places and get that human reading on the ground. And I thought, in this day and age where we're bombarded by information, where we constantly have too many pixels coming at us, that we want to create a new news organization, particularly for an emerging generation of journalists, that will be part of that process of really calibrating the technology of our time and the overload of information by getting the true reading, the human reading on the ground, or the ground truth. And that's why we call our organization the Ground Truth Project.
You've done a lot of work with Ground Truth, and we could spend hours talking about it, but let's, for the time we have, start with, you did a lot of reporting during the 2018 midterm elections in the U.S., both before, during, and after. Tell us about that effort.
Sure. So we had funding, and we basically had a challenge, which was how quickly could you pull together a team that could look at some of the issues around troubles with voting. We were starting to see some inkling of this in Georgia and in Florida and elsewhere in the country, North Dakota. And we just sort of accepted the challenge, and we said we are very connected to universities and journalism programs around the country. We put out the word, and we very quickly assembled a team of 60 student reporters who we put out into 15 states, but we concentrated in three states, Georgia, Florida, and North Dakota, where we had lawsuits or allegations of voter suppression. They did fantastic work. They went out, talked to reporters on the line, good old-fashioned shoe leather reporting, seeing what the problems were, keeping an open mind, looking at these issues. And I think if you step back from the 2018 midterms, voter suppression is going to emerge as one of the key issues in two very close races, Georgia and Florida. And in Georgia, we're already seeing Stacey Abrams, the Democratic gubernatorial candidate, is already saying she's laying the groundwork for lawsuits to say there was voter suppression, there were attempts here. Going into 2020, I think it's one of the big issues. So we're really hoping to continue that reporting on those issues.
So tell me just a second about the logistics of that. You had a team, you said, of 60 people. These were journalism students? Were they recent grads? Or who
they were journalism students. This was a kind of a sense on our part that we were a little bit on the sidelines on this election. We don't typically cover politics. This was not a big initiative for us, but it was something that we just know we can be very nimble and we can move fast, and we wanted to. I would say it was a pilot in some ways for 2020. We want to build that out with much more purpose and much more planning for 2020. But we did our best in 2018 because we just felt like this is a crucial election. These young student journalists answered the call really quickly, and we're now offering fellowships to a competition for two fellowships to them to do more reporting on this leading into 2020.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard four times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with an immensely talented crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to catch up with me on Twitter, you can do so at JM Lutis. Joining me, as he does every week, is my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller, an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal. Wayne is also the author of 17 books. You can find Wayne on Twitter at G. Wayne Miller, all one word. And our guest this week is Charlie Sennett, a veteran journalist. He's currently the co-founder, executive director, and editor-in-chief of the Ground Truth Project, a nonprofit news agency supporting journalists working in the undercovered corners of the globe, including right here in the United States. You can find his work on Twitter at CMSENNOTT and also at Ground Truth. So what are the outlets that are taking your reporting? Are you publishing this? Yeah. Does Ground Truth publish this yourselves, or are you giving it to other?
It's a great question. So Ground Truth, we do approximately 30 reporting fellowships a year. Those range between about a month and a year. We tend to want to give people the opportunity to go and do really in-depth reporting. We then partner with our editorial partners to get the work out there so we have broader reach. So we work with PBS Frontline. We work with PRI The World. We work with The Atlantic Magazine. We work with a number of different publications around the digital space to try to really put it out there. And we kind of tailor it depending on who's best for the project. But we like to think that we are ending up reaching very large audiences for the size of our news organization. We only have 12 full-time employees. But through these fellowships and through editing and working as producers, we produce documentary films through Ground Truth Films. We produce our podcast, the Ground Truth Podcast, and we produce mostly immersive multimedia on deep social justice issues in the U.S. and around the world.
And what a wonderful experience for these young people. I mean, how formative. I'm thinking, again, your early days that you were talking about.
Well, they've done amazing work. So we watch what happens when an emerging generation of journalists are given the opportunity to do the work like we were given. You know, when we came up in this craft, there was more opportunity. I'm very frustrated that there's not enough opportunity for emerging journalists. I see their talents. I see that the pipeline is broken. And Ground Truth was born of trying to find a new way to reestablish that pipeline for talent so that you could go from reporting locally to take on some bigger challenges. And so at Ground Truth, we have it written into our mission statement that we're supporting a new generation of journalists to tell the most important stories in the world and in the U.S. And we somewhere in our mission statement, it says we also cover divided societies and struggling democracies. And in the summer of 2016, we really began to realize America is among those struggling democracies and divided societies that we should pay more attention to. We'd been in Egypt, we'd been in Myanmar, we'd been in Iraq, we'd been in Afghanistan, we'd been all over the world. But right here in our own country, there were deep divisions. And Steve Waldman, who's the co-founder of Report for America with me, had an idea that he called Report for America in a report that he had written. It was a concept paper, and he and I began talking about what would it take to take that idea and really bring it to fruition, and how Ground Truth is really a good home for that. So we now have launched this new initiative, and we're calling it Report for America, like Teach for America for journalism. We're saying this is a call to public service for young journalists to come forward and to do local reporting as public service in communities that aren't being heard in America. And that is really our newest, and in many ways, our biggest initiative that's come out of Ground Truth.
It's so very exciting.
Why, so we talk, we hear stories about news deserts where there's just been the disappearance of local news outlets. And I can remember, I'm old enough to remember the time when the Huffington Post and the Patches were all gonna solve all of that through citizen journalism.
Right.
Why doesn't that model work? Why is something like Report for America necessary?
I think the thing about citizen journalism is it jumps over a lot of the great news organizations that do exist, that have great values, great traditions. They have great lessons for younger journalists to learn. What we love about Report for America is this idea that by having a host newsroom, which is what we call them, take a Report for America core member, as we call them, core as in C-O-R-P-S, like Peace Corps or Marine Corps, and go forward into these communities and really embed in those local news organizations so you can pull in the great knowledge base that comes from the editors and the reporters who've been there and done it for a long time and really know the community. We also have a built-in audience, so you can really be serving the public service of an audience that's yearning for information about its community. Particularly where there are news deserts, they're often in states, for example, where the large newspapers or public radio stations might have pulled back their coverage from more rural areas or deeper inner city areas that aren't getting covered. We see Report for America as an opportunity to create a funding formula where those news organizations that exist can go back to, in many cases, those rural beats that they once had. Or if they didn't have them before and the local newspaper out there in the rural community perhaps faded or died, they can actually serve that community and they can be there on the ground to do that. So it's very much a funding formula where we want to work with these local communities. We work with newspapers, public radio stations, digital news organizations. We are totally platform agnostic, as they say. Mm-hmm. But we're devotional to the communities, and we really want to be there as part of the community service.
And so you provide half the funding for the folks in these newsrooms. The other half comes from?
That's right. So we'll come with national foundation and individual funding. We'll come in and pay half the salary of the reporter. We ask the news organization to pay 25%. And then we say to the community, you need to raise 25% to support this because it's for your community. So we want buy-in from the news organization, buy-in from the community, and we'll match that.
Wow.
It's a great model and wonderful thing.
Thanks. So Steve Waldman, who has for years thought about this and in many ways was way ahead of the curve on thinking about local news and the emergence of these news deserts, I think one of the things in his model that is really exciting, and you guys put your finger right on it, is to bring local funders in. Like, that's what's missing. We know we can get national funding. We have a good track record from Ground Truth. We can really build Report for America. We can scale this. But what we're hearing from the foundations is we need to find new revenue. We need to find ways to take the funding we get from them and double it. And that's what we're able to do through creating the match with the news organization itself and the community.
So I've read a number of the reports, and they're outstanding.
Thanks.
I got a real sense, and knowing, you know, the age of the people that were writing these, I got a sense of enthusiasm and excitement that I don't want to say you don't always see in the reports from more accomplished and veteran reporters, but mm-hmm. but that's really what I'm saying. Was that a true reading? I mean, I've just got a sense of real
thank
commitment
you for reading them and
passion and like, wow.
And Ground Truth.
Yes.
What we're trying to say is when you're doing your Report for America service year, or we offer up to 2 years, so we hope people will stay for 2 years. While you're doing that, you're serving that community. So you might be writing about planning boards, you might be writing about City Hall, you might be writing about some local issue, the school boards, whatever. What we're doing at Ground Truth is we're saying to those Report for America reporters, give us 2 essays a year that we can nationalize. Really tell us what it's like where you live, like bring it home. Think of this like a dispatch or a postcard from where you're doing your service. And we are trying to curate that collection of essays and come up with a new voice of a new generation of journalists that we hope will speak directly to their generation. So what's missing for a lot of young people is they don't hear voice on local news because there's not enough young people doing it.
Right,
so we're trying to pull this forward. So they, the Report for America core members, do wonderful work on their own for their host news organization. We're trying to create Ground Truth as a brand that pulls a few stories a year forward and says, what's the one that could really allow you to take someone who doesn't know what it's like to live in Pike County, Kentucky, or in Mingo, West Virginia, or, you know, in the Mississippi Delta? Bring us to those places.
Rural Georgia, like Samantha Max is one of many reporters that I could cite.
Thanks for reading that. Wasn't that an amazing
story? That was
story?
Outstanding.
What I loved about Samantha's story was her honesty in saying,
yes.
As a reporter, sometimes you run into people who you just want to help. And right, she was dealing with a very, very sick person who was really struggling.
And she was divided.
And she felt
my
like, you know, I'm here to tell your story, but how can I help? That struggle within Samantha embodies our hope for the spirit of public service that's in Report for America. I can't help her with the equation of how do you balance that, because we can't be advocates and journalists. We want to encourage her to think of journalism as a role, but the instincts in her for public service, to be thoughtful, to be caring, we love that. But we also want her to get grounded in the idea that journalism itself, when it's done well, when it's fair, when it's balanced, when it's impartial, when it's not partisan, when it's about people and it's about what they're going through, that is a public service in itself.
We've got a few minutes left. I want to pick up on a story that you published through Ground Truth, a Jewish holiday celebrated by Christian Zionists. Takes you back to your Middle East days. Tell us about that story.
Sure. So for me, that story is an outgrowth of the time I've spent in Jerusalem, a city I really love. I had 2 children born there, actually one in Jerusalem, one in Bethlehem, but we lived in Jerusalem the whole time. My wife and I really, when I was based there for the Boston Globe as the Middle East bureau chief, came to love all sides of that divide. I mean, we had friends who were Palestinian, we had friends who were Israeli, we had friends who were religious, we had friends who weren't. But what drew me into Jerusalem was just as a grew up Catholic, Boston Irish, sort of a very traditional upbringing, I wondered what's happening to the place where my faith was born when the people who are the living presence of that faith disappear. So Palestinian Christians are disappearing. And that became a very elegiac body of work for me. And anyone who knows me might be chuckling. I'm not religious. I think much to my mom's dismay. But I am someone who cares about my faith. I think about it. And I felt pulled to that story. I can't, maybe the nuns got to me young. I don't know what happened, but
they always do.
Yeah, so,
I can speak to that too.
I knew for a fact that this story mattered to me, and I wanted to tell it. So as I started to tell it, and the Palestinians were disappearing, then I realized, wait, there's a whole cohort of Americans who are coming to Jerusalem, and they're flooding the place. And I started to talk to them, and none of them knew that there even are Palestinians who are Christian. And I'd say, yeah, you know, they're part of the continuum of our faith for 2,000 years in the place where it began. They'd be like, no, Palestinians are Muslim. And I'd say, no, you gotta be kidding. They're Catholic. They're from the Anglican Church. They're from the Eastern Orthodox churches. Are you kidding? And I saw this at what was at first ignorance and has become something else, which is even worse, which is an avoidance and in some cases a hostility toward the Arab population that is Christian, because it complicates their narrative where they want to be pro-Israel. And they want to say that there is a theology called the End of Days. Yeah. Many people who watch your show might know about this. They may have read the books Left Behind or be evangelical Christians themselves and have heard about this theology, which is from the Bible, and I respect theology, but it's troubling in its end goal, which is to say we need to have Christians come to Jerusalem in support of Israel so that we can have an ingathering of Jews in an apocalyptic vision of the world in which then there will be a great war, and then there will be the second coming as the Christians see it, or from those Israelis who are starting to embrace this, far-right Israelis in the settlements are saying, we'll figure out whether it's the first time or the second time the Messiah came, when he gets here, or I would say when she gets here.
Yeah, it's a powerful story to leave it on. We're out of time.
Yeah.
Charlie,
okay.
Thank you so much for being with us. He's
Thanks.
Charlie Sennett, the Ground Truth Project. That's all the time we have this week, but if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter or visit pellcenter.org. He's Wayne, I'm Jim. We hope you'll join us again next week for more Story in the Public Square.